Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I start today's program with something I wrote. Give us this day, our day of Trinity, with a quote from Kate Wolf. Now the sun has come to earth, shrouded in a mushroom cloud of death. 75 years ago, in the summer of 1945, a major epoch in human history began. Technically, its origins were a few years earlier, when Albert Einstein wrote a letter to American President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, or when scientists set off the first sustained nuclear reaction underneath a Chicago University sports stadium on December 2, 1942. One of the scientists remarked that breaking one of nature's barriers meant tragedy for everyone on Earth. Following that curtain raiser, it took a few more years of utmost secrecy involving more than a million people and some of the world's most brilliant scientists to develop the mechanism of an idea, culminating in an astonishing experiment that exploded several times brighter than the sun and worried more than a few of its creators that the world would crack open or the sky become a crematorium. That day was today, July 16th, 1945, at 5:29:45 a.m. Mountain Wartime, the birth of the nuclear age, the day of Trinity, which should have atomized the suddenly extinct calendar designations of B.C. A.D., is not applicable. The first atomic bomb was detonated at the top of a tower in the New Mexico desert at Alamogordo bombing range, 200 miles south of Los Alamos Nuclear Research Center, secretly built to develop the bomb. Richard Rhodes, who wrote a many awards-winning book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, described the sequence of detonation of that first ever human-devised nuclear explosion, here somewhat condensed. Neutrons drilling into the surrounding plutonium to start the chain reaction, fission multiplying through 80 generations in millionths of a second, tens of millions of degrees, millions of pounds of pressure as the plutonium core became an eyeball that for a split instant resembled the state of the universe moments after the first primordial explosion. Quote, unquote. And from Peter Wyden in his book, Day One, Before Hiroshima and After, a yellow-reddish fireball infinitely brighter than the sun, its temperature 10,000 times greater, began an 8-mile ascent, turning night into day for more than 100 miles. And from the book by Frank Morton Sass, it was just before 5:30 a.m. in New Mexico on July 16, 1945. The world was changed forever. The first atomic bomb was detonated, sending a mushroom cloud 5 miles into the pre-dawn sky. Perhaps the apocalyptic feel went a hand in naming the test site. A sudden wave of heat seared across the desert, and Trinity's huge blast echoed across the valley. The fireball shot into the sky, followed by the boiling, black, and twisting, gigantic mushroom cloud, which has ever since been the totem of the nuclear age, as familiar a symbol as the cross and the star and crescent. Scientific and military observers were positioned several miles away from the blast in various sheltered bunkers. One of the high-ranking military spectators later wrote that a brilliant flash of light lit up the desert. A searing light lighted every peak, crevasse, and ridge with a clarity and beauty that cannot be described. It was that beauty great poets dream about, but inadequately describe. And that's a quote. J. Robert Oppenheimer, the brilliant scientist whose so-called bohemian-like eccentricities and worrisome claims that he had joined every communist cell in the USA caused a great deal of mistrust to military and government civilians alike, was the lead scientist at Los Alamos. Oppenheimer said he had been influenced by poet John Donne when he named the atomic bomb detonation site Trinity. Batter my heart, three-person God. And that's from Donne. He also referenced the three destroying gods of the Hindu religion, as cited in the Bhagavad Gita, which he carried with him everywhere. Oppenheimer's most memorable remark was a quote from the Bhagavad Gita following the Trinity detonation. Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. He did indeed think about the implications for mankind, for the thing we created and the wall into the future we had breached, he said. Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson might have had it right when he lamented, in Oppenheimer's recollection, the appalling lack of conscience and compassion that World War II had brought about, the complacency, the indifference, and the silence with which we greeted the mass bombings in Europe, and above all, Japan. Oppenheimer said that Stimson felt, as far as degradation went, we had had it, that it would take a new life and a new breath to heal the harm. Or, as U.S. Air Force General Curtis LeMay, commander of the B-29 bombers that firebombed Japanese cities, put it, we knew we were going to kill a lot of women and children when we roasted a town. Those firebombings were used as a base mark for use of the atomic bomb, that, in the words of one government official, the number of people that would be killed by the atomic bomb would not be greater than the number already killed in fire raids. Total death in total war, as writer Richard Rhodes called it. For example, on March 9, 1945, 2,000 tons of incendiary bombs were dropped on Tokyo, destroying 16 square miles of the city. 80,000 civilians died that night, more in one night than the entire total of deaths in England during the Blitz of 1940-41. The general idea of nuclear war and atomic chain reaction came from a book by H.G. Wells, author of War of the Worlds, The Time Machine, and dozens more futuristic novels and nonfiction books, including A Children's History of the World. His novel that literally caused a chain reaction among scientists was titled The World Set Free, published in 1913, just prior to World War I. In the book, 200 cities were demolished by a process Wells dubbed atomic disintegration. 20 years later, a Wells's fan and physics scientist and a former student and close friend of Albert Einstein, Dr. Leo Szilard from Hungary, who, like Einstein, fled the Nazification of Germany, envisioned an atomic chain reaction while in exile in London, which was inspired by Wells' book. And almost in serendipitous chain reaction, another physicist, Otto Hahn, whose interest in atomic science, like so many of his era's peers, could be traced back to Ernest Rutherford, the father of nuclear physics, split the uranium atom, which caused a chain reaction of scientists splitting atoms like peas, quote-unquote, on both sides of the Atlantic. Szilard, who was described by fellow scientists as the man who has thought longer and harder than anyone else about the consequences of atomic chain reaction, and without whom the U.S. might not have so readily developed an atomic bomb, argued at the outset of World War II that the Nazis were theoretically computing what might be considered the world's first nuclear arms race. He referred to America's moral advantage over Nazism, but also more practically insisted that the USA could outproduce every other nation in heavy armaments. The only real enigma was that by preparing to test and use atomic bombs, the U.S. would lose that primary advantage when other nations acquired nuclear weapons. In just a few years, Szilard said. He was prophetic. Remember, this was 1939, the year World War II began. Perhaps the greatest immediate danger which faces us, Dr. Szilard said, is the probability that our demonstration of atomic bombs will precipitate a race in the production of these devices between the United States and Russia. The arms race truly began 2 months before Trinity at the Potsdam Conference of U.S., British, and Russian allies in May 1945, directly after the Nazi surrender. Germany's surrender without really getting close to developing a nuclear capability created substantial doubts among Los Alamos scientists about the necessity of continuing construction of an atomic bomb. A few thought that at least the remaining Axis adversary, Japan, should witness the Trinity demonstration and perhaps decide to surrender before its use. Both ideas, stopping work on the bomb or revealing its existence, were nixed. Share the bomb ideas with allies, including Russia, that emerged before the Trinity test were also put to rest with the admonition that absolute secrecy, although British scientists worked on the research and development from the start, was of utmost necessity, which could be defined as, don't tell the Russians. Of course, as was suspected and finally deduced, Russia had developed a very capable network of atomic spies at Los Alamos and within the USA in general. At Potsdam, the U.S. personified by its new president, Harry Truman, following Franklin Roosevelt's death the previous month, sought to impress Russia in the personage of Joseph Stalin with its military might by alluding to having solved the nuclear conundrum. The Russians, whose awesome communist revolution had occurred at the end of World War I, little more than a quarter century earlier, the past 4 years spent repelling the savage invasion by Hitler's Huns, were anxious to commandeer the Eastern European nations the Nazis had formerly conquered as payback for the 20 million Russian dead in the war. They were already shaping up to be America's post-war nemesis by dropping what Winston Churchill called an iron curtain on an imminent Soviet Eastern Empire, beginning a half-century Cold War, some of the most glaring casualties of which were the spies who had filched the USA's nuclear secrets and were executed or imprisoned. Russia cracked the atom 4 years later in 1949. America's immortal poet laureate, Walt Whitman, had crystal-balled the subsequent Cold War a century earlier. You Russians and we Americans, our country so distant, so unlike at first glance, such a difference in social and political conditions, and yet in certain features and vastest ones, so resembling each other. And that was Whitman. And so, nearly up to the last minute that the bomb was finally ready to be exploded against Japan, psychologically, the new enemy was really Russia. But Japan was still the immediate foe. It was estimated, rightly or wrongly, that it would cost the USA anywhere between 1 to 10 million casualties in conventional war against Japan and would most likely obliterate the Japanese as a people. Use of the atomic bomb would ensure considerably less death and destruction all around, although its use set up a doomsday clock ticking for humanity as a whole. Not to mention that Oppenheimer had opined that it might take as many as 50 atomic bombs to subdue Japan, and that those bombs would be produced with assembly line regularity at Hanford to be sent along the aerial supply line over the Pacific Ocean to the massive B-29 base on the island of Tinian, essentially 7 or more bombs a month. But after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, a third bomb was unnecessary. The only real surprise had been the speed and effect of radiation, which had been predicted to be limited and contained in a small area, burned off in the bomb's explosion. Although initially reports from Japan about the lethal spread of radiation were considered a hoax, it proved to be more insidious than biological warfare, killing tens of thousands in the immediate imminence. Many, many more tens and hundreds of thousands were afflicted and deteriorated and died in the decades to come. Downwind from Trinity, radiation exposure rates in New Mexico counties were measured at levels 10,000 times higher, that's a quote, than currently allowed, another quote, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. In 1947, alarms were raised about infant deaths. Finally, the U.S. Department of Energy admitted in 2006 that the Trinity test spiked the most significant exposure of the entire Trinity project. And at Hanford, which produced the plutonium for Trinity and thereafter for most of the 60,000 nuclear weapons built for the U.S. arsenal until it was decommissioned in 1991, cleanup and decontamination of highly toxic radioactive material removal is expected to continue until at least 2030. In 1989, the Hanford Reservation made the list of America's worst contaminated sites. Hundreds of tons of radioactive metal is yet to be decontaminated and disposed of, and unaccounted for wastes have leaked into the Columbia River, downriver from Hanford, for more than three quarters of a century. From 1944 to 1947, Hanford officials knowingly released radioactive iodine into the atmosphere without informing the public. In 1990, the Department of Energy admitted that these emissions might be responsible for the high incidence of thyroid cancer in the region. Richard Rhodes wrote that no one should presume to judge these scientists as they struggled with a future that no one could barely imagine. Yet their vision was intrinsically narrow in their desire to expand science and break through nature's primal barriers. They seemed to trivialize the direct consequences of unlocking nuclear power, which unleashed immediately depopulated two human cities in overwhelming carnage. The future they created started off wrong. It would seem as though all the discoveries of science and their applications to warfare culminated in the splitting of the atom and its use as an apocalyptic weapon of annihilation. One of the Trinity scientists said after its successful detonation, "I am sure that at the end of the world, in the last millisecond of Earth's existence, the last human will see what we saw." And another Trinity scientist, back at home in New York City after Trinity and Hiroshima, reflecting that a similar single bomb could pulverize Manhattan, for which the entire nuclear bomb project was named, wrote, "I would see people building a bridge, and I thought, they're crazy. They just don't understand. Why are they making new things? It's so useless." And that was something I wrote. Give us this day, our day of Trinity. And now, A Matter of Choice by Stephen Anderson. We are speaking now of a choice that is in a way prior to all other choices. And because of this priority, it is a fundamental moral choice. And what is more, it is a fundamental moral choice that no one can make by themselves, since it pertains not to how we shall act singly, but rather to how we shall act together. It is a fundamental collective moral choice. Insofar as each of us makes a moral choice to favor one or other collective alternative, we do it alone somewhere in the recesses of our hearts. But the relation of this individual decision to the collective moral choice we are speaking of is as a symbol, an omen, or an increment of the destiny to which our collective choice will lead us. We are the points in a photograph which is only now being developed. The choice is whether to survive as a civilization, and perhaps even as a species, or to bring our history to an abrupt and spasmodic end. This is a fundamental moral choice. That it is also a collective choice is made clear by the situation that confronts us with it. The social organization, technological sophistication, and political will needed to construct a mechanism capable of pulverizing hundreds of cities in the space of an afternoon all show that what we have going in this country and in others is a public enterprise of vast proportions, and public enterprises at any level are nurtured, sustained, or abandoned through the exercise of collective choice. This is as true for a military establishment as it is for a local daycare center. We are not speaking here of democratic processes or their absence in this or that society, because the issue in this case calls for a moral consensus which cuts across the spectrum of human political and social organizations and penetrates to the very source of human will and feeling. In the matter of collective moral choices, the people always rule. Nothing can erode the validity of this choice except the restriction of information. To put the point in another way, based on what you know about the nuclear arms race and the threat to life it represents, you will either express a willingness to see it stopped, or you will accept its continuation. Either way, you will have added to the growing consensus of humankind to the testimony of our own moral sense. Silence is one of the languages of acceptance. This applies to the Soviet people as well and as much as to you. They too sustain a public enterprise which could bring history down around us overnight. And although the potential for their being misinformed may be greater and their means of expression more restricted, they are neither kept in the dark about the consequences of nuclear war, nor are they deprived of language with which to express their moral sense. So the suggestion is not one of a cosmic ballot box into which each of us casts our one vote in suspense for the future of the race. Your means of expressing your moral sense are much more complicated than that. For one thing, this expression can take many different forms, depending on your understanding of political process, ability to act independently of the approval of others, economic status, social skills, obligations to family, friends, employer, and the strength of your resolve that a certain public enterprise should be abandoned. Another consideration is one that we should explore as thoroughly as we can because it could make the final difference, our emotional response to bad news. For if the response is disabling, and if the severity of the response increases in proportion to the badness of the news, how can we ever engage our moral sense in the reflection on our predicament necessary for a valid collective choice in the face of what looks like the worst news imaginable? Denial is the natural initial response to the impending loss of something we hold dear. The problem is that in this case, that we hold dear is in practically everything, and to be paralyzed by fear and denial seems likely to only increase our chance of overwhelming loss. There is something that must be understood before we shall be able to adequately address the problem of denial in the nuclear age. Each of us has personal projects, social and loving relationships, family ties, varied obligations, plans for learning and experiencing, programs of spiritual, moral, and aesthetic growth. These constitute a kind of universal for human individuals, and a successful life means at least putting some effort into the challenges these things pose for us and not giving up. our best and first hope must be that the historical situation will allow it and will not defeat us with events from outside that we are incapable of absorbing. We want to live in normal times so that we can get on with living. But these are not normal times. The truth we cannot avoid is that we are not living in normal times. We are living in what is perhaps the most brutal and barbaric period of human history, a nuclear war. Even a so-called limited nuclear war would, setting aside for the moment the physical destruction and suffering it would entail, an inexpressible scandal in itself, constitute for us a collective and moral collapse. Until we understand this, we are unlikely to devote the moral energy needed to overcome denial and find a way to express our determination to participate in a positive way in the collective moral choice we are now making. And that was A Matter of Choice by Stephen Anderson, who lived in Cannon Beach when he wrote this for the North Coast Times Eagle in 1982, and he was the leading member of the North Coast chapter of Citizens Action for Lasting Security and national editor of Pandora, a newsletter of philosophers who opposed the nuclear arms race. And now, Second Death by Jonathan Schell from his book, The Fate of the Earth. If a council were to be empowered by the people of the earth to do whatever was necessary to save humanity from extinction by nuclear arms, it might well decide that a good first step would be to order the destruction of all nuclear weapons in the world. When the order had been carried out, however, warlike or warring nations might still rebuild their nuclear arsenals, perhaps in a matter of months. A logical second step, accordingly, would be to order the destruction of the factories that make the weapons. But just as the weapons might be rebuilt, so might the factories that make the weapons, and the world's margin of safety would not have increased by very much. A third step, then, would be to order the destruction of the factories that make the factories that make the weapons, a measure that might require the destruction of a considerable part of the world's economy. But even then, lasting security would not have been reached, because in some number of years, at most a few decades, everything could be rebuilt, including the nuclear arsenals, and mankind would again be ready to extinguish itself. A determined council might next decide to try to arrest the world economy in a pre-nuclear state by throwing blueprints and technical manuals for reconstruction on the bonfires that had by then consumed everything else. But that recourse, too, would ultimately fail because the blueprints and manuals could easily be redrawn and rewritten. As long as the world remained acquainted with the basic physical laws that underlie the construction of nuclear weapons, and these laws include the better part of physics, as physics is understood in our century, mankind would have failed to put many years between itself and its doom. For the fundamental origin of the peril of human extinction by nuclear arms lies not in any particular social or political circumstances of our time, but in the attainment by mankind as a whole, after millennia of scientific progress, of a certain level of knowledge of the physical universe. As long as that knowledge is in our possession, the atoms themselves, each one stocked with its prodigious supply of energy, are, in a manner of speaking, in a perilously advanced state of mobilization for nuclear hostilities, and any conflict anywhere in the world can become a nuclear one. To return to safety through technical measures alone, we would have to disarm matter itself, converting it back to its relatively safe, inert, non-explosive, 19th century Newtonian state, something that not even the physics of our time can teach us how to do. And that was by the late Jonathan Schell, Second Death, from his book, The Fate of Earth. And this is Michael McCusker. Stay safe. Protecting yourself protects everyone else. wear your masks in public.